tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for practice.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. In these challenging times, one thing that brings us together and gives us hope is the galvanizing power of giving. Donate to KBOO's end-of-the-year drive now at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Join the thousands of KBOO supporters and invest in making a better world we all know is possible.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say.
Good evening. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we're talking with author Helen Dale. Helen, welcome to Transpositive.
Thanks very much, and thanks very much for having me on your show.
Oh, thank you. So Helen, you're a transgender writer.
That's right, yes. Yes.
Oh, that's and you live in the UK?
I live in the UK, in Salford, which is a city right next door to Manchester, which people are more likely to have heard of than Salford, probably famous for things like Manchester United football team. I think that's fairly well known around the world.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Manchester, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, here in the United States, we hear a lot about the UK. I mean, on our public television station, like, we see that sort of thing all the time. I think, like, everybody knows about Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was, like, a popular show in Britain, but...
Yeah, it was quite popular over here as well. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and the Great British Baking Show. That's what... that's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep, yep. They're probably that's a good not one our too. Best exports, I must admit.
Yeah. Of course, we got the Beatles from you all, and we got the English language and Shakespeare, and we also got our system of government. So,
yes.
But anyways, it's a pleasure talking with you. We are transgenders, transgender writers. We're both from the same group, and that's how we met.
Yep.
And you are a very accomplished writer. And so I think what I was hoping to do in the show tonight, besides just, you know, kind of stumble around talking about cultural similarities, is I'd love to hear your coming out story. I would just kind of love to hear your story, if you'd like to share it, for starters.
Well, I spent probably the best part of 50 years thinking that I was cross-dressing. And then I was doing some contracting work, which one contract finished Christmas Eve one year, and I was promised another contract to start in the March, April, that sort of time. So I took the opportunity to start living 24 hours a day, 7 days a week as Helen, to see if I'd get bored with it, because I'd been feeling that maybe it wasn't just cross-dressing, but that I was, to use a term that was around at that time, transsexual rather than transvestite. So I started to dress 24/7, apart from when I had specific things to go to involving officials, and then I would dress as a male. Unfortunately, the new contract didn't materialize, and I had to go back to work as male. And it was getting to the point where I was getting up in the morning thinking, I can't do this anymore. I'm pretending to be a guy, and my real gender is female. And at that point, I started to look into medical transition, and I started seeing a psychiatrist who then eventually referred me for surgery. Unfortunately, the workshop that I was working in, because I was doing computer engineering at the time, terminated my contract when they found out that I was planning to transition. But I actually ended up getting a much better job with my very first interview as Helen, and that was with the probation service in the UK, what I think you would term the parole service in the United States. Mm-hmm. To criminals who are not actually in prison, but doing community service and that sort of thing. And I was IT project manager with them in Manchester for the next 18 years until I retired.
What are attitudes in your country towards transgender people? When you transitioned, it sounds like you were fired, you were discriminated against because you transitioned. Was that a common attitude at that time towards
it
transgender?
It was very
people?
Common back in, because we're talking 1998, 1999, mm-hmm. And I actually had some research on the internet at the time and found that 97% of trans people had lost in the UK, lost their jobs or had to leave their jobs because of transition. In some cases, it was because they were doing jobs which were quite macho and they no longer felt comfortable doing those jobs. But for a very, very high percentage, it was because they were being forced out of their job because of transitioning. Later, we started to get legal protection in the UK, and things are a lot better than they were in that respect. But there has been some backlash over the last 3 or 4 years, mainly since we voted to leave the European Union. There's been an awful lot of discrimination increases against a number of minority groups, and trans have been one of those. And a review of our Gender Recognition Act was carried out, but the government decided in the end not to proceed with the recommended changes because of complaints from trans exclusionary radical feminists, what we call TERFs. And that has caused a fair bit of problem. People like J.K. Rowling making big noises about trans issues and basically spreading lies about us. I do quite a few workshops for different groups, and I did some during our lockdown period due to COVID online and with women's groups around the UK. And I got nothing but very positive responses from all the people who attended those. I belong to a swimming group or an aquarobics group at my gym, and I'm just accepted as one of the girls as part of that group. Back tomorrow lunchtime, we're having our Christmas lunch, and I will just be one of the girls on that. So most people accept us. Most of the remainder couldn't care less. And there's a small minority, the trouble is they're very vocal, who try and cause as much trouble as they can for trans people in the UK.
before we get into your writing, I'd like to just talk a little bit more about your transition, because you've mentioned quite a number of interesting things. One is, you mentioned that for about 50 years, you were a crossdresser. And I was wondering if you think that your story is typical of a trans story. I mean, back in the 70s and in the 60s even, a lot of people didn't even know what transgender was. I mean, but people were still exploring their gender identity. You mentioned in one of your books an experience that you had when you were a teenager, I think. And were you cross-dressing when you were a teenager?
Yeah, right from sort of 11 years old, that sort of age, I was, and maybe earlier than that, but certainly at that sort of age, I was dressing in female clothes. Was it cross-dressing now that I identify as female? Well, that's how I saw it at the time, that's for sure. Although we didn't have a name for it back then, or we weren't aware of a name for it back then. People didn't talk about it. At that time in the UK, being homosexual was illegal, and was being trans illegal? Nobody knew. And you couldn't even ask the questions, otherwise you were attracting attention to yourself. And I only found the word transvestite when I went into a dirty bookshop in London, Soho, and found some magazines in there featuring other people who wore women's clothes like I did. And that first found out that I wasn't the only person in the world who was doing what I was doing. And I think that's fairly typical. And certainly a very high percentage, certainly a majority of male to female transgendered individuals who transition have previously identified as cross-dressers, but eventually found that that wasn't sufficient for them and that they needed to do something further. Now, whether that was because in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s even, there was not enough information about what the possibilities were, and whether younger trans people will start their transition process a lot earlier now that we have the internet with all the information that's on there is a good question. You know, I'm certainly, as a counselor, dealing with young trans people who are transitioning, so more awareness around now.
When you were cross-dressing, did you go out in public as a cross-dresser, and did your loved ones know that you were a cross-dresser?
Nobody knew about my cross-dressing until 1999. I managed to hide it very, very effectively. And yes, I went out in public from the age of about 16. My first time out as dressed was when I was about 1963, so I'd have been 16 years old at the time. And I went down to London from the middle of East Anglia, which is the eastern part of England. So changing in the toilets on the trains and things like that. So it's quite an adventure, that was.
Can you tell me about some of your experiences as a cross-dresser from like 1963 through 1999? Did you have positive experiences where cross-dressing really affirmed your identity as a woman? Were you treated with respect by other people in the public, or were you mistreated?
I tried to be as stealth as possible, and if anybody did realize what I was, then the chances were I would get laughed at the very least. I didn't actually encounter any physical abuse as such. I mean, I'm quite a large person, so I'm probably more likely to intimidate other people than anything else. I certainly had a couple of run-ins with police who were quite offensive about what I was doing and threatened to record the incidents on their system, although as I said, it wasn't clear whether or not just cross-dressing was illegal. In fact, I don't believe it was, but they could always use the excuse of, well, it was likely to cause a breach of the peace. But I never actually got into, was never charged or anything like that by the police at that time. As I said, I tried to be as invisible as I possibly could be while I was dressed. So I didn't attract any attention. And back then, people just saw what they expected to see. The lack of information about trans people kind of worked for us back then as much as against us, because people didn't expect to see trans people. The only cross-dressers they saw were on television, people in the UK like Danny LaRue, the equivalent of RuPaul, that sort of individual. So there was very little female impersonation going on back then, so very little awareness of it. That only really started to come in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. And I guess that was partly on the back of the AIDS epidemic that started about that time.
Were you aware of other people who were also cross-dressing? And how did you deal with the complicated issue of sexual orientation? Did you see yourself as queer? Did you just see yourself as a cross-dresser?
Saw myself as a cross-dresser. I didn't identify as gay or straight in that respect. I had got married in the early 1970s and was married for until the late 1990s. And I have a daughter. So as far as sexual orientation was concerned, I saw myself as heterosexual, as a heterosexual male, rather than at that time a heterosexual female. Now I would see myself as pansexual. So it's kind of the individual that attracts me, regardless of what their gender is, rather than whether they're male or female.
Hi, we're just interrupting the show today to remind you today. I hope you will consider donating to KBOO. You can donate now at kboo.fm/give or text to KBOO at 44321. Thanks, and back to the program. When you came out, did you come out to your ex-wife or to your daughter? And how did they receive that?
They actually took it okay. I mean, by then I'd been working away from home for several years. So my wife and I weren't living together at the time. And she had, in fact, earlier asked for a divorce or said she wanted a divorce. But I said, well, not until our daughter's finished university. And it was actually after Joanna, my daughter, had finished her university degree that I came out to the two of them. I'd been to the Rocky Horror Show. Now, as a guy, they would have seen me as very straight-laced, not likely to go to anything like the Rocky Horror Show. So when I told them that I'd been, they were quite surprised. So I said, well, wouldn't have thought you'd go to that sort of thing. So, well, it's 60s music, and I like 60s music. In fact, it's not that they didn't know that. My ex-wife, my now ex-wife, just said, oh, right. And that was the end of the conversation with her. My daughter then said, did I dress up for it? I said, what do you think? She said, no, I don't suppose you did. I said, well, you're wrong. I did. She said, what? Stockings and suspenders and all that? I said, yeah. She said, did anybody take any photographs? So I said, yes. So she said, well, I've got to see them. Well, the next time we met was at her graduation, and I wasn't going to rain on that parade. But the time after that was at her mum's house. And as soon as I walked through the door, it was, where are those photographs? So I insisted on having a cup of coffee first. And they said, well, where are those photographs now? So I showed them to them, and they burst out laughing. I said, you find it funny me being dressed as a female, do you? They said, yeah, it's hilarious. I said, well, you better look at the rest of these, because I'm trans and I do it all the time. And my ex said, "Pardon?" So I repeated it. And my daughter just said, "Oh, cool." And she accepted it from that point. And we've been on holiday together. We've shared rooms together. And in fact, this Christmas, I'll be spending Christmas with the two of them.
It's so nice to hear a story where a trans person transitions and then they're, you know, they're accepted by their family of origin. I mean,
yeah, I mean, my mother struggled with it at first, but she eventually accepted it. My father was already dead by then anyway. Not sure he would have accepted it, but that doesn't matter. My sister also struggled with it, but she's accepted it since. And all my family and friend relations, they're the ones that matter anyway. They've been fine with it, which is not always typical, that's for sure. I mean, as I said, I'm also a counsellor, and I've dealt with a lot of trans clients who have lost family and friends totally as a result of transition. But I've also known quite a few who have succeeded in retaining their relationships. You just don't know how it's going to go pan out when you, if you tell people. And I always warn people, well, you've got to be prepared to lose all of your family, all of your friends, your job, everything if you do transition. If you don't lose in everything, you hold on to some of the things, then you've been lucky.
I wanted to ask you about your work as a counselor, because it sounds like you are somebody who provides mentorship and works with people who are in transition. Can you talk about your work?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing it now from, I started training as a counselor when I was looking at transitioning myself. And it seemed to me that that was one possible area that I might be able to have a career when I did transition. In fact, as I said, I got a job with the probation service. So I did most of my counseling back then on a purely voluntary basis, mainly with the Lesbian and Gay Foundation in Manchester, until they changed some of their rules and I then went independent. I don't do a massive amount. I don't treat it as a business. I'm there if people need me, if they get a referral from or a recommendation from somebody who's dealt with me in the past, then I will work with them. At the moment, I'm working with two individuals, both of whom happen to be female to male, which 15 years ago, I probably wouldn't have encountered that number at that time. So, but I've dealt with well over 100 individuals who've transitioned as a counsellor. And I used to chair a trans support group in Manchester. And we probably had 300 or 400 people through the door. And I've been involved in other trans support groups as well, and LGBT groups providing support. So, yeah, I mean, I also, as I said, I was the first openly trans individual employee within the probation service in England and Wales. And when another probation area found out that I was there, they got in touch with us and said one of their staff was looking at transitioning as well, and could I give them some advice? So I got in touch with them and I went down to see them, provided some training down there for them and supported that individual, and then kind of snowballed, and I ended up supporting about another half dozen members of staff around the country who were transitioning. So kind of became the de facto trans lead for the probation service nationally.
You mentioned that you work with the probation service. I'm curious if you have direct knowledge or experience of how people are treated who transition or who seek transition while they're incarcerated within an institution in England. What is the situation like for those people right now?
In theory, they will be treated as their legal gender initially. So they will, if they are legally male, they will go into a male establishment. They're legally female, they will go into a female establishment. If they have a gender recognition certificate, means that they have changed their legal gender, then that will override what their birth gender was. So that's how they will be treated. But if they've been living full time, or if they identify as trans and are living in a different gender to the one they were born in, if they have substantial evidence of having done so for a number of years, they will then be able to apply to be moved into a more appropriate establishment. And that's what tends to happen, and the prison service is supposed to do a review meeting within a matter of days of them being incarcerated. So I know of, I think the last information that I saw was that there are about 85 trans individuals in prisons in the UK at the moment. I've met probably 15 or 16 of them. So I've worked with some, and I've done a lot of training with police, with prison officers on working with trans individuals. And in fact, I served on the National Offender Management Service Diversity Board for a number of years while I was chair of the LGBT Staff Association for the Probation Service. And I did actually write a protocol for working with trans offenders in probation and in prisons, and I contributed to a national policy that is currently in force.
This is Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. So Helen, before we get into talking about your writing and talking more about some of your transgender experience, you've had a long life, and so I've just got to ask you a couple of questions, your experiences. So I'm dying to know, did you ever see the Beatles?
No,
never did.
I was never really a fan of the Beatles. I much preferred Dave Clark Five. In fact, I had a bet with a friend of mine at the time that the Dave Clark Five would outlast the Beatles. I'm not saying they were a bigger group, because they weren't, but they did outlast them. So, Barry Brackenborough, if you're hearing this, you owe me five bob.
And I also read, and I think I read in your bio, that you received an award from Princess Anne. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was for work that I did with trans offenders, both in prison and probation.
Did you go to London to get it? Did you go to Buckingham Palace to get that award?
Yes, it was at Buckingham Palace that I received the award. So I was able to take my daughter, which was quite a thrill for both of us.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience? What was it like?
It was very interesting. I mean, we went down to London the day before and stopped in a hotel, and then getting in a cab in London and saying, "Buckingham Palace, please." And the cab driver turned to us and said, "So are you getting an award today?" And I said, "Yes, I am." I think he guessed that from the fact that I was wearing a hat. And we got there, and there was probably about 100 of us receiving the award that day for different work that we'd done in the prison and probation service with offenders in one way or another. I think mine was probably the first time somebody had received an award for working with transgender individuals within the probation service. I was quite proud of that, I have to say. It was quite a spectacular setting, obviously, in Buckingham Palace. We were in the throne room, and seeing where the Queen would normally sit and things like that was quite exciting.
What was Princess Anne wearing, do you remember?
She was wearing a green dress, and she had her hair done up in her normal kind of bouffant, I think it's you'd call it, style. And the dress was, I can actually look at a photograph on my wall. It was about 3/4 length, that sort of thing. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, how wonderful. Congratulations for that honor.
Thank you very much.
Anyway, so back to your story. So you are a writer, and you've written at least, I think you've mentioned three books. Have you written three books, or probably more than that?
I've written more than that. I've written three fiction books. Two of them are novels, and one's a novella. Then I've also done an autobiography, a handbook on working with trans individuals as well. While I was doing some research amongst my files, I came across a diary that I kept when around 1996, 97, when I was considering whether to transition or not, and taking other trans people down the gay village in Manchester, which is a very friendly area for LGBT individuals, introducing people to the gay scene, if you like. So I put that, plus some other short stories that I'd written about that time and other anecdotes, and I've kind of created a bit of an anthology, which I've called Transgender Tales. So those are the sort of half dozen books that I've written so far, and I'm in the process of writing another couple of novels at the moment.
tell me, what is the name of your memoir?
And, it's called A Tale of Two Lives, kind of a take on the Charles Dickens story, A Tale of Two Cities. And the subtitle is A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Palace, which is a kind of takeoff of a play that was around in London some years ago called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. So that's kind of the title of it. And it really covers me growing up. My father was in the Air Force, so we moved around quite a bit. And we lived in England, obviously, plus a couple of years in Iraq and a couple of years in Paris. So a bit of story about that. While I was growing up, I wanted to be a pilot in the Air Force myself. Unfortunately, I'd had hay fever, so I couldn't do that. But I did join as an officer cadet, but in an admin role. But I was straight from school, green as anything. And they realized that if they put me in charge of a group of men at that point, they'd have torn me apart. So they told me to get a job meeting people for a year. But I never actually went back into the Air Force. I ended up going into public relations and marketing and advertising and that sort of thing. And it goes through what I've done, my history, some exciting things that I've done. I joined a group when I transitioned that did sort of adventurous things. So most weekends I'd be doing something, and then I go into the office on the Monday morning and people say, so what did you do this weekend? And I say, oh, I flew a jet, or I did some fire eating, or dived with some sharks. And people would say, well, you really ought to write your autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
So I did.
Well, that sounds so interesting. I mean, your autobiography sounds so interesting. So it's set in kind of two parts, your life before transition and your life after transition.
Yeah, it kind of goes right through.
Yeah. When you transitioned in the late 90s, did you know a lot of people at the time who were transitioning? Because that was still a little bit early, like in terms of trans history, both in the UK and the US. It still wasn't that common. I mean, trans people were becoming more visible, but they still weren't that visible. So you must have been one of the first.
Oh, no. Well, there'd probably been a few thousand before me.
I mean, in terms of visibility, that's really what I mean.
there were quite a few around, but
we're just interrupting the show today to remind you this is an opportunity for you to use the individual power of generosity to remain connected and to support your community. In these challenging times, one thing that brings us together and gives us hope is the galvanizing power of giving. Donate to KBOO's end of the year drive now at kboo.fm or text KBOO to 44321. Join thousands of KBOO supporters and invest in making a better world we all know is possible.
A friend of mine and myself, I don't know if you remember GeoCities on the internet?
GeoCities, yes, from a long time ago, yes.
Well, we had two websites on there that were trans-related, and it was a bit of a friendly rivalry between us who had the most visitors to their website. And I guess ours were amongst the top sort of half dozen visited in the UK, certainly, and maybe even internationally as well. So yeah, we were both fairly visible at that time.
People were coming to you to like just learn about your experience. Was your transition at the time covered by the National Health Service?
No, I was in my 50s, I was overweight, and I smoked. And those were three things that the National Health Service would not have appreciated. And at that time, they were kind of operating a three-tier system unofficially. if you were young, very convincing, likely to succeed very easily in a female role, then you were prioritized. If you were like me, then your chances of getting any treatment within any acceptable period was zero, really. And then the rest kind of fell between those two extremes. So I actually ended up going privately. Fortunately, I had an insurance policy that was maturing, which covered the cost of my surgery.
Has the situation changed with the National Health Service? Is it easier now for people, regardless of where they're at in life, to transition?
They're more open to different individuals' experiences and probably less judgmental in terms of appearance. They will still insist on you being below a certain body mass index and don't like it if you're smoking still. But the waiting lists have gone out massively. You could be waiting 3 years just to see somebody, let alone getting any referral for surgery.
So it's still difficult to transition in a timely manner in England.
To get surgery, certainly.
Yeah.
Not everybody, of course, wants surgery. And it's easier to transition socially. So, you know, you can switch your presentation, no problem at all, if that's what you want to do. You can, after 2 years, apply for a gender recognition certificate. And so long as you meet certain criteria, you can change your legal gender. And then that's you're then of that legal gender. You don't have to do that, but you can do it. People who are transitioning are protected by our Equality Act. If they still identify as transvestite or non-binary, then they're not covered by the Gender Recognition Act, by the Equality Act, rather. So it's not an even playing field for everybody by any stretch of the imagination. But if you identify as somebody who wants to transition from their birth gender or birth sex to what they term an acquired gender, then you have got legal protection against discrimination. Doesn't always work, of course. There are ways around it. And people do still lose their jobs and things like that as a consequence of transitioning. But in theory, we have protection.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that you mentioned was non-binary identities, which, at least here in the U.S., non-binary is really the fastest growing demographic group within like the trans spectrum. And yeah. Non-binary people are really making up a majority of like the new demographic of young folks who are kind of coming out. And a lot of those folks are people who were assigned female at birth. I'm wondering, how are non-binary identities being understood in the UK, and how are they being accepted?
Well, there has actually today been a judgment in our Supreme Court, which says that somebody had tried to take the government to court to say you have to accept non-binary on passports and the like, but that has been rejected by the High Court in the UK. They are looking at taking it to the European Court, but whether or not that will succeed, I'm not sure. I suspect not. I wonder to what extent people who are identifying as non-binary will remain identifying that way permanently. I spent 2 to 3 years wondering whether I was cross-dresser or I needed to transition. If I was a cross-dresser, then I was male, cross-dressing as female. If I wanted to transition, then it was because I was female. Now, in that interim, I guess I could have described myself as neither male nor female, non-binary, or maybe gender fluid, or some other description like that. And I wonder to what extent a lot of the people who are currently identifying as non-binary are in that area where they're not sure what they're doing at the moment, and whether all of those will consistently identify as non-binary, or whether they will eventually come down one way or the other. I'm not, you know, I regard non-binary as a totally valid identity, don't get me wrong, but I do wonder how many of them will remain in that area.
Thank you. We're talking tonight with Helen Dale. Helen is an author and a resident of the UK and a person of transgender experience. Helen, I'd like to get back to your books. You've also written a couple of nonfiction books. Did you say some, at least two novels? Can you tell me about your novels?
Yep. The first one is called Summer Dreams, and it was inspired by an incident when I was about 19 years old. I was living in London at the time, and for a holiday, I took the trains in the UK around the south of England. And on one day, I went down to a town called Bournemouth on the south coast. It's got huge sandy beaches, and then a harbour with a ferry across to an area called Studland. And I took the ferry over, and I sunbathed on the beach and went swimming in an orange bikini when I was 19 years old. And while I was sunbathing, I noticed the guy watching me. So I kind of panicked, and I quickly ran off, got changed, and went back into town. And then I thought, when I remembered this incident, well, what would have happened if I hadn't noticed him? What would have happened if he hadn't minded that I was trans? Where would that have led? That inspiration became my novel, Summer Dreams, about a young trans girl who actually gets into a relationship with this guy that is watching her on the beach. Yeah. And it's set against the period when the Gender Recognition Act was becoming law in the UK. So there's political background in there. I've also woven in a story about a trans offender in prison and what was happening with trans offenders in prison at that time, and the sort of reaction that people got who were visiting those individuals, and then changing attitudes and things like that. So there's a fair bit of historical accuracy and background to the novel. It was set in the early 2000s, so around 2000. It starts around 2003 and goes through to about 2005, I think it is. Yeah.
So what becomes of the relationship between your main character and her love interest?
They get married.
Oh.
She gets her gender recognition certificate, so she becomes legally female, which means that they can then marry. And they end up having children through surrogacy. You know, there are twists and turns in there, and she does attempt suicide a couple of times, or considers suicide a couple of times. She attempts it once. So there's, as I said, there's historical accuracies and realistic. I think it's an authentic story of trans people, because I've used a lot of the experiences that I've heard of through my work with other trans individuals. So the descriptions, I think, are really quite accurate.
It reminds me of that Spanish film from the 1970s. Where the dancer transitions and eventually she marries the director. But anyways, I'm sure that there's been several plot themes along that line, but it sounds like a one. Were you inspired in this in writing this novel by any other sources? Did anything inform your writing, or was this something that just came from your own personal experience?
It was more my own personal experiences and that of other people that I know. I have to say, I did get quite jealous of the character's name is Vicky, and I did get quite jealous of Vicky's relationships and things like that. So, yeah.
And what is the name of that novel?
It's called Summer Dreams.
Summer Dreams. And is it available? Like, if people were looking for it, could they find it somewhere?
It's online? On Amazon, and I'm trying to get it into through Ingram Sparks into bookstores as well. I think it's likely to get into the bookstores over the next few weeks.
Oh, great.
Or bookstores will be able to order it, at least. I doubt very much if many will buy copies on spec to stock. You know, but if somebody went into a bookstore and said, I want this novel, then they would be able to order it.
Helen Dale. Helen is a transgender author and a writer and a resident of the UK. And we've just been talking about Helen's novels and her experience, her life experience. Helen, I wanted to make sure we got to your other novel too. Can you tell us about the other novel that you've written?
Well, there's two other fiction books that I've written. One is a second novel called Changes, but there's also a short novella called Operation Busted Flush. And that's actually set in the US. And it kind of was triggered by the way Trump was dealing with the transgender community in the United States, and particularly the way he was dealing with the armed forces and stopping people who were transgender from serving in the armed forces. And I thought, well, what would happen if there was a group of former special forces individuals who were trans who took objection to that and decided to take action against the Trump administration? And the novel does look at that, and it includes a character that I had in Summer Dreams as well, called Jackie, who was ex Special Air Services in the UK, and she's since moved to the United States to be with her grandchild, who is also trans, and there's others in the group from Delta Force and Green Berets and things like that. And we look at what might happen. It's only a short one, but that's also available on Amazon.
You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio today. And remember to help KBOO reach our $45,000 membership drive goal by showing support today at kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Every donation is appreciated. Donald Trump, worse for the United States, or was Boris Johnson worse for the UK?
You've got rid of Trump. We've still got Boris Johnson.
That's true.
Much more long-term than Trump's were.
Mm-hmm. I found it really interesting in our conversation from earlier when you mentioned that Brexit led to kind of increased hostility toward minority groups, including members of the trans community. Could you just share a little bit more about your thoughts on that?
Well, the day after we voted for Brexit, I was in a local shopping center, and there was a local guy who went up to a woman who was sitting outside our a post office, and she was dressed as, she looked like a Muslim. Whether she was or not, I don't know, but doesn't matter. But he started abusing her and saying, "We voted to get rid of your lot now, so F off, get out of here," sort of thing. And I'm afraid that the Brexit vote gave bigots permission to do that sort of thing. I actually faced up to the guy and said, "What the hell is wrong with you? You know, what's she done to you?" And he took his cap off and tried to hit me with it, and he just flicked the hair on the front of my head. And I just looked at him. He was smaller than me, because I'm 5'9", 5'10", and I weighed quite a bit more than he did. I could have knocked him down if I wanted to. I didn't touch him. But sadly, there has been a lot more hate crime recorded since the Brexit vote took place. And a lot of it is simply because people feel emboldened to be more homophobic, misogynistic, transphobic, racist, the lot. And it's not the country that I knew 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Do you see things changing for the better in the near future?
Not while the Conservative Party is in power. Okay. And sadly, I don't think we've got an opposition that can stand up to them. Yeah. This is the worst government I've seen in my 74 years.
Well, so what is the near future look like for you, Helen? Will you be continuing to write? Do you have any books in the works?
Yeah, I've got two more novels that I'm writing at the moment. And as I said, I've just published the novel Changes, which is also available on Amazon. And I'm hoping to get into bookshops as well. And that's a novel that also has a... I mean, all of them have a trans protagonist at some point or other. And I'm trying to show in the novels that being trans is just a part of the individual. It's not the main part of them. It's just part of their background. And I'm trying to get beyond stereotypes of trans people. So although there will be some who will be victims, some who will be sex workers, and that sort of thing, that's not the prime part of the novel. It's much wider than that and tells a bigger story than that, and gives a lot more information about what it means to be trans. And I belong to a women's writers group, and some of my friends in the group said, "Well, you know, you've informed us about trans issues without forcing it down our throats." And that's what I'm trying to do with the novels as well. So it's not about trying to make a fortune like J.K. Rowling. It's about getting the story out there, educating people about what it means to be trans, and trying to get a bit more understanding about our situation and show that we're not a threat. You know, the idea which people have tried to promote in the UK that we're men who want to use the excuse of pretending to be women to get into female toilets to attack other women is utter lunacy. You know, so I'm trying to portray a different viewpoint to that. Whether I'll succeed or not remains to be seen.
What makes for a good story, Helen? Like, what makes for a good story?
Grabbing the reader's interest, making sure that they can associate with the character. They may not always like all of the character, but maybe bits of about the character that aren't quite very nice or maybe suspicious. But get them involved and keep them guessing about what's going to happen. So, you know, my novel Changes is actually told from five different viewpoints, and a couple of them are quite unpleasant characters, but, you know, I try and keep the reader guessing what's going to happen at the end.
I love that style of writing. There's a writer who wrote a book here in the States about 3 or 4 years ago, and it was set in Mill Valley, California. And it told the story of the consequences of childhood bullying, and it followed these characters through the course of their school years, from grade school all the way through to the end of high school. And it told the story from each chapter was from a different character's perspective, so that by the time the novel was finished, you had had the experience of maybe 13 or 14 different characters who all had different areas of association with each other. And it's one of my favorite reads from the last 2 or 3 years. So it's a great novel.
Yeah. Well, you know, one person is going to see things one way, but if you then tell the same story from somebody else's perspective, you can put a different twist on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still the same event. It's just seen from a different side.
Well, Helen, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. Is there anything that you'd like to share about your life or about your writings that people haven't had a chance to hear about so far?
Well, my website is www.helendaleauthor.info. That's Helen, H-E-L-E-N. Dale, D-A-L-E-N, D-A-L-E, rather. And then author, AUTHOR.info. And there are samples of my books on there. I try and put the first chapter of several of my novels on there so that people can have a read, see whether they like my style or not. If they do, maybe they'll buy my book. If they don't, well, that's fine. Everybody has different tastes, and that's perfectly okay with me.
Pleasure having you on Transpositive.
Thank you.
And best of luck with your writing, and thank you for all of the work that you've done to help support and nourish the trans community in your area.
Well, I'm part of it, so I've got to help it if I can. So, you know, that's what we're here for, isn't it? If we don't all contribute, then what's going to happen?
Thank you very much. Thanks. You've been listening to Transpositive here on KBOO. I just want to thank everyone who's given to KBOO's end of the year drive. If you haven't given yet, you can by going to kboo.fm/give. It's our members who literally make shows like this possible. So thanks so much for your support. Bedroom surprise.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO at 5 p.m. on December 22nd and 23rd to hear the premiere episodes of the KBOO podcast, Row on the Rocks. The show investigates what a post-Roe v. Wade Oregon will look like, where many Oregonians already have limited access to abortion health care, even though they live in a state with some of the most progressive abortion laws in the country. What happens when neighboring states like Idaho enact their trigger laws to immediately outlaw abortion care? Experts expect an influx of patients who will travel hundreds or even thousands of miles to Oregon just to receive access to abortion services. Row on the Rocks is executive produced by KBOO's Claire Rosciato. Hear the premiere episodes on KBOO at 5 p.m. on December.